Miguel Mambo De Leon was a fixture in Kansas City's Latin music scene for almost three decades. Though he recently moved away, he'll be teaching an Afro-Cuban drumming workshop in Lawrence tomorrow. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll catch up with Miguel De Leon. But first, attorney Jennifer Harbury worked in a small legal aid bureau along the U.S.-Mexico border in the 1980s. She traveled to Guatemala to witness the reality that asylum seekers were leaving behind. Harbury recently circulated a proposal to resolve cases of unaccompanied children crossing the border from Central America. We'll hear her story and learn how the crisis is affecting Kansas City after this news. How does a 9-year-old make the journey from Guatemala to Los Angeles all by himself? NPR's Kelly McEvers recently told us in a report on Morning Edition.
In early May, he left his house in Guatemala, hooked up with a smuggler, got on a bus for a night and a day, hiked for a while, hid behind a mountain, rode in a car, hiked some more. Then the smuggler left, and the boy walked up to a U.S. Border Patrol crossing and into detention. His mother says the boy had an infection that ruptured his eardrum. She says the boy was taken to a shelter and given shots of antibiotics. Authorities contacted her here in L.A. Just last week, he was released to her custody.
So that's how. The why of the journey remains to be explored. In the last year, there was a nearly 100% increase in the number of unaccompanied child migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, most of them coming from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, many of them reportedly avoiding conscription into street gangs and transnational organized crime. The result has been a humanitarian crisis on the border. Facilities have been crowded with unaccompanied children awaiting trial and hoping to be reunited with relatives as the U.S. wrestles with how to classify their cases. I'm Gina Kaufman. This morning on Central Standard, we're joined by Jennifer Harbury, an author, attorney, and human rights advocate who can tell us more about the conditions these migrant children are fleeing. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning.
We've also got Angela Williams in the studio. She's a local immigration lawyer who can talk to us about what she's been seeing here in Kansas City since the influx of unaccompanied children began. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
So, Jennifer, let's start with you. Your story could be a whole show on its own, but tell us just a little bit, in a nutshell, about how you came to be immersed in the plight of asylum seekers from Central America.
Well, initially, I became very interested in their plight back in the 1980s when the original surge of refugees came over because of the extraordinary extermination campaigns going on in Central America with the death squads. Now I'm very interested and very involved because the children of those victims are now coming up in a similar surge. And I work in the Rio Grande Valley. I live 3 miles from the Rio Grande. I'm very familiar with conditions created by the drug cartels on the other side and more coming across to our side, the militarization and overreaction by many, and the plight of, you know, young teenagers, 9-year-olds even, and young mothers with babies who have been forced out of their countries, which literally have the highest murder rates in the world. You're safer in Syria. Who come up here despite the horrible dangers and stuff just because it's the only way for them to survive, and the reaction of many in the United States to them, and certainly the conditions they've been subjected to.
Can you give us some backstory that might inform our understanding of what's going on now? What's important to understand, maybe dating back to when you were originally exploring this? We see headlines about now, but backstory is sometimes important.
As you're talking about the dirty wars that occurred in Central America back in the 80s that led to the current conditions.
Right.
Yes. I certainly know most about Guatemala, so I'll use that as an example, but it certainly fits for most of the countries in that region. There was a coup in 1954 in which the first reformist government ever was overthrown violently by a group of ragtag military people that were literally backed by the CIA during the McCarthy era. And the country remained under a military dictatorship thereafter. As the war ended 40 years later, the UN Truth Commission ruled that the army had carried out genocide against the Mayans, who were 80% of the population. 600 villages had been exterminated, literally 300 people in an afternoon. Torture and terror had been their daily methods. The economy was destroyed, and they owned the courts and the police department. And the government security forces were found to be responsible for 94% of all of those violations. There were also 200,000 people, including my husband, who were either dead or disappeared at the hands of the death squads. That's a higher total than Chile, Argentina, Honduras, and Salvador combined. The United States was very complicit in all of the scorched earth campaign carried out by the army and was sharply rebuked by the United Nations report as a result.
Is that a view that's shared by a lot of people, or is that something that's still contested today?
That's in the declassified United States documents. It's in the United Nations Truth Commission report. It's in many decisions out of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And it's in the Archbishop's Truth Commission report out of Guatemala itself, which is multi-volume.
So what?
It's a universal, it's not an opinion, it's a universal conclusion based on data.
So what exactly is going on now? What's changed in recent times that so many children are leaving these countries now to make this perilous journey alone?
Well, many of the people after the war ended who had been high up in the army already were involved in the drug trafficking. They're the ones that had airplanes. They're the ones that had the correct kinds of munitions. And they're the ones with airstrips. No one else had those. As the war ended, they went out of uniform and formed what are called parallel structures. In other words, new armies with exactly the same structure, but not under the Minister of Defense. But they still control their friends within the army, and they still control the police and the courts, and they use the same terrifying methods. They have armed, trained, and formed many of the most notorious drug gangs today. I'm not talking about the street kid gangs out of Los Angeles. I'm talking, for example, about the Zetas who are terrorizing my part of the border. And they use the same methods of terror that the army used originally in Guatemala, amputated breasts, teeth pulled out, people gutted, et cetera, et cetera. Those kinds of things are almost signatures, and they're happening today, which is why a young teenager in Honduras or Guatemala, God help them, right? If they decide they don't want to work with the gangs, if they don't want to serve as mules, if they don't want to participate in executions, or if the girls don't want to become prostitutes, they have two choices, run or die. As one young mother said to a rather stupid journalist after she just turned herself in to immigration officials down at Anzaldúa Park recently, she was one of several hundred women to do that, and she was saying that her two babies were sick from the journey, and the journalist said, well, why would you have taken such risk with such small children? And she said, well, the drug gangs just burned down my house. It seemed like we should get out of there while we still could. That's what they're facing. They have to go.
Yeah, it sounds like you're kind of saying risk is relative.
No, I'm saying they're in danger of their lives and they're refugees. They must leave and they must come up here. Well, there are many solutions for our country as to how to properly deal with them, but rapidly sending them back to their home countries without fair hearings is certainly not one of the legitimate or legal ones.
Let's get local immigration lawyer Angela Williams in on this discussion. Angela, what are you seeing here in Kansas City and the surrounding region? Are Kansas City families seeing young relatives arrive unaccompanied from these particular Central American locations?
Yes, even up here in the Midwest. I know my practice itself has seen a sharp increase in the number of phone calls and consultations and people needing representation with young children or unaccompanied minors, or even if they were minors when they got here and now they've turned 18, people under the age of 21. I would say, and I've been doing exclusively immigration and since, I don't know, like 2006. And up until May, I would say that I've had maybe one or two phone calls related to any adult or child Central American asylum claim over the years. It's just not something that we see as often in Kansas City as they are in other parts of the country. But since May, I bet I've had 30 or 40 phone calls and consultations and people coming to my office seeking help related to this exact issue.
I know you may not be able to speak in a lot of depth about specific cases, but can you give me a sense of about how many people have come to you for advice since this started? I know you just got into some of those numbers, but like, who are they and And what are the particular issues that they are facing?
Most of them are Central American from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And the majority of them are under the age of 21. There have been an increase also in adult asylum claims as well, and people coming that have been apprehended at the border and paroled into the country and are now seeking, are in immigration court trying to fight an asylum claim. So that is most of them are that. And most of the asylum centers around violence. A lot of it centers around domestic violence and violence within the home or violence within the community, like sexual assaults.
Can you explain how that plays into it?
Which?
The domestic violence and sexual violence and assault. How does that figure into this bigger picture of a migrant, child migrant crisis in particular?
Well, in these three countries in particular, there's little to no support for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. They're rarely prosecuted. If the people do go to the police, they're rarely investigated. Oftentimes, they have to continue to live with or close to the assailant, and causing them to be re-victimized in many cases until they have to flee to safety.
Can you explain the difference between refugee status and asylum?
Refugee status is something that happens outside of the United States, that it's a process that people go through to come into the United States. Asylum status means that they have arrived here in the United States and they are applying for political asylum. They're similar in that you've had to flee your country, and you've had to flee your country for one of the five particular reasons, which is race, religion, national origin, political opinion or membership in a particular social group. But legally speaking, it's just a difference in how you apply for it. You can't apply for asylum outside of the country. You have to be here, or at least one member of your family has to be here.
What's happening to these kids once they're in the system? Can you give a specific story?
What happens is this. They get to the United States and then they are released to ORR, which is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And then they attempt to find a family member or a friend to release them to. But they're also put into deportation or removal proceedings. And another increase that we have seen in Kansas City is the need to have a special juvenile docket, which we've never seen before. There's enough kids that are here in this situation to have created a docket that's just for the children. In the past, maybe there's been one or two, and the judges handle it by calling that case first and not bringing the rest of the people into the courtroom because they're private. In many other parts of the country, there's always juvenile dockets, but in Kansas City, we've not had the need for juvenile dockets. So they get here, and then they are in removal proceedings, and unless they find a pro bono attorney or their family can hire an attorney, they're by themselves, because you have the right to have an attorney, you just don't have the right to have a free attorney.
Wow. Okay. So, Jennifer Harbury, you circulated a proposal urging the use of temporary protected status to classify these children and resolve their cases. Can you explain what temporary protected status is and what it would do?
Yes, this is a measure that was used before when so many refugees came up from Central America. It's tried and tested, and it makes a lot of common sense. When there's an extraordinary situation in another country, such as Honduras and Guatemala right now, and there's a surge of refugees, the president and the Department of Justice can decide that they will not deport that category of people for the time being. They're legalized. They're released. They can work and support themselves. They're not on the government dime. And they can stay here, for example, for 2 years, and then the government reevaluates their security situation and can either send them home then or renew their TPS for another year or so until it is safe. So they're here temporarily, and they reunite with their families. They can work, and they take care of themselves. They go to school like everyone else. And we don't have the incredible crunch that we're seeing on the border. What's terrifying to me is the wish to expedite their removal, either by rushing them through the system or curtailing certain protection rights. And in a case that I've had recently, a young woman was sent back to Mexico who said several times, "My husband will kill me. He's with the Zetas. He's a drug runner." I have protective orders against him. I've been here for years. They sent her back and found her burned to death in a car.
We need to not
do that again.
Yeah, we'll find out more about that case when we come back. Central Standard's going to take a quick break. We'll also find out how Kansas City cases fit into that international context. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guests today are Jennifer Harbury and Angela Williams. Jennifer is an attorney, author, and human rights advocate. She's speaking this evening at the Lawrence Public Library. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And Angela is a Kansas City-based immigration lawyer. Hi again, Angela.
Hello.
So, Angela, how do you work with clients who are children who don't have parents to serve as their guardians? Is that a complicated dynamic?
It is sometimes because depending on the age of the child, it's, you know, the guardian, which sometimes is not their parent, which might be an aunt or an uncle or a cousin or some distant relative, is coming in to talk to me. And so they want to know, obviously, what's going on with the case, but I'm really representing the child. And so that always, when you're representing children, that always makes it a little bit difficult in trying to tell whoever, even if it's their parents, tell the whoever the adult is that I need you to leave the room because I need to talk to this kid, because there's a lot of times stuff that has happened that they don't want to talk about in front of their parents. And in order to assess whether or not going an asylum route or going like a special immigrant juvenile visa route or going some other type of route is going to be best, I need to hear their whole story that's unedited if they're, you know, don't feel like they can share some of the things in front of their parents or their guardian.
Can you talk about the part of the journey that happens between a border crossing and an arrival in the United States? Because we've heard a little bit about the leg of the journey that gets them across the border, but Kansas City is not right on the border.
Right. What happens is, like I said, if they're an unaccompanied child, they get usually apprehended or in most cases recently have been turning themselves into immigration, and they get originally and initially taken in by Customs and Border Patrol, which is CBP, and that's the people that like guard the border right down there. And then they will, once they determine that they are in fact unaccompanied and they are in fact minors, they transfer them to ORR, which is the Office of Refugee and Resettlement, and they are moved to then a different type of living facility where they evaluate them for education and health and various things, and then try to locate someone that can take custody of them. And that sometimes is a parent, sometimes it's a distant family member, sometimes it's a friend of the family, but they try to locate someone that might be able to take them in. Once that child is released to that person becomes not their legal guardian, because that is something that has to happen at a state level, but they become their, maybe custodian is a better word for purposes of immigration. They're responsible for taking them to court. They're responsible for following up on that kind of thing. And then their case is transferred to wherever that guardian is. So that's how we're ending up with the number of unaccompanied children here in Kansas City in the middle of the country.
Are the kinds of cases that Jennifer Harbury described to us, the kinds of conditions people are fleeing, is that all of the cases you're seeing, or are there other kinds of issues mixed in?
All of them are fleeing because of something horrendous that has happened. Sometimes it is domestic violence. Sometimes it's a sexual assault. Sometimes it's violent attempts to recruit them into a gang. Sometimes it's extortion or violence against their parents, and their parents have become afraid to have them there any longer. But all of them are leaving because of extraordinary violence and extraordinarily difficult circumstances. None of them that I have encountered are saying, well, I just came up here just because I'd rather be here.
Right.
They're all fleeing from something.
Right.
And that's similar, like I did some work in a family detention. That's similar with the women and their children at the family detention center, too. They're fleeing. They're asylees.
Is poverty a piece of the picture, or is it violence across the board?
Well, poverty is a piece of the picture in that I think poverty in a lot of times begets violence and begets a lot of these conditions. But like if you look at places like Nicaragua, in which we're not seeing hardly any refugees, and which hasn't experienced the tremendous violence and social upheaval as Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and they're really poor countries. So it's not just poverty. And that's something that I want to stress. I think the news a lot of times paints these children and these women and these I'm not going to say migrants, these asylees that are coming here as economic asylees. And while poverty is a factor, it's this journey up here is tremendously difficult, particularly to send your child by themselves. You don't do that just because you want them, you know, to come up here and get a job.
You know, I want to get both of our today's guests answering this question because you kind of touched on this. But when you hear people discussing this crisis along the border, what do you think are the biggest misunderstandings underlying those conversations, the biggest gaps in knowledge or information about the situation? Jennifer, let's start with you.
Well, certainly most people think that these people are coming up here because they either are riffraff or just want money or want to take advantage of our system somehow. And that's simply untrue. They're refugees in the truest sense of the word. I know our time's short. I just want to give an example of one of my clients who was 15 in Honduras when they first started coming to recruit him out in the cotton fields when he was working. He refused. He was badly battered. The second time they ran over him with a car, he woke up several days later. His mother gave him all the money in the house and said, run. He got to Guatemala, where the local bandidos took all the money away. He ran into the police, who battered him badly. He got to Mexico, took the train north on the roof, saw a friend fall off and get run over, and was himself badly battered at several stops. At the border, he was grabbed by the Zetas, who wanted to force him and other kids to work for them. He refused. They were shooting some of the kids. They all ran different directions. He jumped into the river and nearly drowned, made it to the other side, and was promptly picked up by immigration officials who put him at an ORR center. This was several years ago. It wasn't properly supervised, and he was sexually abused. He's still doing okay. He's making it. These kids are the strongest and the most determined to get their piece of the American dream, and we should be proud of them and welcoming them.
Angela, what is your sense of maybe what a piece of information that a lot of people don't have that could help them make sense of this?
One of the ways that I think this is being incorrectly spoken about, particularly in the media, and so then therefore has an incorrect perception among the general public, is that this is the same as our immigration crisis in the United States, that these refugees, these asylees, are somehow can be solved in the same way that we are trying to solve the issue of the 11 million undocumented people here. They're completely separate things.
What's the difference?
Well, the wave of these people coming here are seeking asylum. And as I mentioned before, there's not any other way to do it except to arrive here and say, please help me and please protect me. That kicks in a whole secondary process of interviews and various things. But these people are coming as asylum. They're coming as something has happened in my country to cause so much chaos that the government has lost control of the population, and they're coming here seeking protection. That is a different problem with a different solution than what we do with the 11 million undocumented people in the country, who many have been here for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, you're hinting at this, but what you do hear people saying at times is that stricter enforcement along the border would solve this problem, that people wouldn't come if we had more enforcement.
It wouldn't. This is what asylum is for. This is the reason we have an asylum program. This is why we have asylum, is because there's a recognition around the world, particularly in first world Western countries, that sometimes not first world Western countries lose control of the population, and sometimes people have to flee. This is the only way you can do it, is show up here. They're not trying to elude Border Patrol. They're walking right up to Border Patrol and saying,
hey, I'm here.
I need protection. That is what you do. And so just because ultimately they may not have a winnable asylum claim doesn't make them more illegal. And it doesn't make them less asylum seekers.
Jennifer Harbury, have you ever seen a case that you would say was handled well? Is there such a thing?
I have in the past many years, especially when I was in Guatemala a great deal. People were given asylum once they reached the United States, who clearly were going to be killed if they were sent back. What disturbs me very much right now is that at least in our region in Texas, with some of the courts of law, they're interpreting the asylum standards and similar standards in a way that do not square with the international standards for refugee status and political danger. So, for example, we had the woman who had been battered for years by her Zeta boyfriend. She finally gets him thrown out by the courts of law in Texas, who issue protective orders. And he went back to Mexico saying the next time he'd see her, he would kill her, which he believed since he'd already burned her trailer. She was picked up one night for a faulty brake signal. She told him she had protective orders. She told him the history. She told him about the Zetas. They never sent her to the courts for a hearing. They just bundled her back across the bridge 2 hours later, 6 a.m. She didn't even have time to find a lawyer. He found her a day later while she was collecting the money to have a coyote get her back safely. He tried to bite her ear off, and a family member rescued her. And 3 days later, she was found in a burning car dead. We need to get a lot more serious about the way we're treating refugees. It's life and death. Enforcing the border in a more strict or harsh manner and militarizing the border area, all that's doing is driving bona fide refugees, including all these desperate and endangered children, deeper and deeper into the desert where the death rate is going to increase rapidly.
Jennifer,
this is the wrong approach.
You mentioned that the process here hasn't always been squaring with the international standards. Can you talk about the international standards and what the international community's position on this is?
Yes. For example, the Convention Against Torture, if the person is likely to be tortured if sent back and the government cannot or will not protect that person, such as in a drug war zone, then they're not supposed to be sent back. But we have routinely, down in South Texas especially, seen people being sent back who have presented very strong evidence that the gangs are going to kill them. And they're sent back anyway, this woman being one classic example. Only recently has the BIA higher up straightened out our region of courts on the issue of domestic violence, where if the woman really can't get away from the husband and the police will not protect her, then you've got to not send her back. So the whole issue of the drug wars and those zones of Mexico and certainly most of Guatemala and Honduras, those people should never have been sent back in the first place. And I'm hoping it will begin to change now as the public becomes more aware of what they're really facing.
That's all the time we have for this important issue. But Jennifer Harbury's talk at the Lawrence Public Library this evening might be an opportunity to explore it further. She's been with us from the studios of KPR. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you very much to both of you.
And Angela, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Central Standard's going to take another short break. When we return, we'll shift gears. Latin musician Miguel de Leon will be joining us to talk about an Afro-Cuban drumming workshop. Stay with us.